From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, now that Arizona's new employer sanctions law is a reality, we'll feature a report from Claudine LaMonaco on the impact it will have locally, as well as the effort to have the new law changed. In a guest commentary, we'll hear the thoughts of former Republican Congressman Jim Colby on employer sanctions. Christopher Conover reports on next week's presidential primary election and the candidates' efforts to attract more Hispanic voters in Arizona. The Tucson Weekly announced their endorsement pick from the field of candidates who competed in Project White House, and I'll talk to the Weekly's Jim Nensel to get the latest. And new studies indicate that southern Arizona's bird population is on the decline. Robert Rappaport will look at some reasons why. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. It's now been a month since Arizona's employer sanctions became law, although legal action challenging its constitutionality has pushed back any prosecutions. Across the state, employers have been slow to enroll in the mandatory E-Verify program. Next, Claudine LaMonaco looks at how some business owners are responding and at the efforts already in action to change the new law.
A couple of weeks ago, Gloria Goldman needed to hire a new employee, so she tried to sign up for E-Verify. That's the federal government's voluntary online program to verify workers' immigration status. Arizona's new employer sanction law makes it mandatory for all businesses in the state. To sign up, you have to pass an online test, and Goldman didn't do so well.
You have to get 70%. I think I got 68. That was a little humiliating because I don't like failing, you know.
The score came as a surprise because Goldman is one of Arizona's top immigration attorneys. Today, she's at her computer at her Tucson office, trying again.
I'm typing my name into user ID. I'm giving them my
Goldman
email.
Worries that if she's had problems with the system, what's going to happen to other small business owners who might not be so up on immigration laws or computer skills?
They make it so difficult to even get through the process of being qualified. I'm not sure what's going to happen in the general population when they try this or they give up and then not follow the law, which they have to do.
Only around 17,000, or just 11%, of all Arizona businesses have signed up for the program. Goldman isn't surprised. She says the system is a bureaucratic mess that takes up a lot of employers' time and money.
You have to hire someone, put them in training, do the I-9, and then do E-Verify and face all the consequences. You're going to continue training somebody who may not be qualified, and then you have to start your whole process of recruiting again, which just is ridiculous that anyone, I don't know if these people that did this really are in the real working world.
Arizona State Representative John Kavanaugh, a Republican from Scottsdale, was one of the main supporters of the law. A former police officer, he says he's never owned a business, but he dismisses criticism about E-Verify.
You know, any business that has trouble using E-Verify, you know, let me know, and I'll send a 13-year-old high school student over to show them how to work that simple internet program. So I think that's a bogus argument. They're grasping at straws to try and knock this bill, but it's not going to happen.
He says law-abiding business owners should be happy about the program.
I know people who are using E-Verify, you know, a year ago, who said it's quick and it's easy. And in terms of the cost, I mean, who doesn't have an internet connection nowadays? And if you don't, you could probably easily hire a company to do it for you.
That's exactly what Republican State Representative Bill Kopanicki did. He hired a full-time worker to check employees at his 9 McDonald's when he enrolled in E-Verify 3 years ago. But he says not all businesses can afford to do that. He says the law is riddled with errors that make it illegal, especially regarding the use of E-Verify.
It is against federal law. You can't go back and do employees in the past. You can only do new hires. The Arizona law requires you to use it on all employees, which is, again, against federal law. So if we want to spend the next 25 years in court, we can, or we can fix it.
The Safford Republican voted for the bill, but now he's one of its principal critics. Kopanicki has introduced 6 bills that he says would fix it. The changes include making enrollment in E-Verify voluntary to comply with federal law and making it apply only to new hires. He bristles when people accuse him of gutting the law.
It does not gut the employer sanctions law. None of these bills gut the employer sanctions law. In fact, Everything I'm proposing enhances the law and makes it enforceable.
Back in Gloria Goldman's office a couple hours later, she's still wading through the 250-page study guide for E-Verify, trying to get it right.
Procedures, and there are three-day deadlines, and there are eight-day deadlines, and there's a two-day deadline, by the way, that I noticed. And my concern is when some employers find how cumbersome this is and what the potential problems are, they may start to steer away from anyone that might even look foreign, let alone sound foreign, which is wrong. But they may do it. Nobody will ever know. They'll decide someone else is more qualified just because. I think it's bad. We'll see.
The judge reviewing a lawsuit filed on behalf of business owners will release a decision on the law sometime in February. Arizona Public Media. I'm Claudine LaMonaco.
Tax reporting. I don't think so. And protects jobs for authorized U.S. workers. I don't think it does. But whatever.
Next on Arizona Spotlight, former Congressman Jim Colby offers his thoughts on employer sanctions.
On January 1st of this year, Arizona launched what some would call a bold experiment. Others would describe it as a big step backwards. Alone among the 50 states, Arizona is going to attempt state law enforcement of national, that is, federal immigration law. Frustrated, exasperated with federal law enforcement officials' inability, or unwillingness, some would say, to enforce immigration law, Arizona has made it a crime for an employer to knowingly hire a person not legally entitled to work in this country. The penalty for hiring a person not entitled to work is severe. In fact, the second time it happens, an employer can lose their license to do business permanently, and that means forever. Now, many Arizonans would answer, good, it's time we got tough with employers who are hiring people illegally. Many of us would agree with that. But there are more than a few problems with the legislation. Herewith a selection of just a few of those problems, which should give pause to all Arizonans concerned with fairness and responsible law enforcement. First, there are many uncertainties in the drafting of the legislation. For example, does it apply only to hiring done after January 1st, or does it cover employees previously hired who may be in illegal status? Second, many contend that the database used to check whether a job applicant is in a legal status has an error rate as high as 25%. Does that mean a lot of Arizonans who could be hired legitimately will be rejected for work? Third, there is no exception in the legislation for emergency or vital services. So it's quite possible we could see a hospital or a nursing home suddenly lose their license to do business and be shut down. And then, what of all the good employees that would be put out of work when a large employer is closed? What happens to them? Do they simply become a burden on the state's unemployment rolls? Beyond these questions about the specifics of how the law will be applied, there are broader questions. There is the overarching economic question. Does the law simply ignore the economic reality that a state with fast growth and low unemployment simply has to rely on labor, whatever the status of the individual doing the job, for the low-skilled work that keeps the economy humming? There is another question that no one, not the legislature, not the courts, seems to have addressed. Could the legislation be fundamentally, even fatally flawed, because it is based on state enforcement of federal law? Only the federal government, after all, its agencies or courts, can determine who is legal and who is illegal when it comes to entitlement to be in the country or to work, because it is federal law that defines that status. So, if an employer is hauled into Arizona court and threatened with losing his or her business license, can they argue that the state can't make a determination as to whether the individual employee who is the cause of the sanction is in illegal or illegal status? Can they argue that only a federal agency or court can make that determination? Above all, one thing appears crystal clear about this legislation. It highlights the real need to deal with this problem at a national level. You can't deal with it one state at a time, each state with a different approach. You can't deal with employers hiring people who are not in legal status without also dealing with border security. You can't punish employers unless you give them some fail-safe way of determining whether their employees are legal or not. And you can't jeopardize the health of our already fragile economy unless you find a way to be sure there are people to do the jobs which keeps the economy going and the United States competitive with the rest of the world. It's time for Congress to address this problem. Never mind that it is an election year, or that they failed miserably last year to address the problem. We can't afford more delay, more uncertainty, more divisiveness in this country. The time has come for Congress to act. now.
Coming up, a look at next week's presidential primary. The Tucson Weekly is endorsing two candidates on the ballot who are probably not familiar names. And a look at why the number of wild birds in Arizona is down. Stay tuned for more Arizona Spotlight right after this break. At this stage in the presidential race, with the field as narrow as it is, every victory and every loss is a major turning point. The remaining candidates are each looking to gain momentum over their rivals, and with Arizona's presidential primary happening on Tuesday, there's much at stake. Christopher Conover brings us the story.
In just a few days, Arizona voters head to the polls to cast their ballots in the presidential preference primary, and pollsters and pundits are working hard to try and predict who'll come out on top. And the candidates are giving one group of Arizona voters in particular a great deal of attention.
Nuestro voto elegirán al próximo presidente de este gran país. Nuestra candidata es Hillary Clinton, porque respeta nuestra cultura.
Latino voters make up 9% of the overall electorate in the United States, according to the Pew Hispanic Center. And in Arizona, that number is assumed to be higher. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 29% of Arizona's population is identified as Latino. That compares to just 15% nationwide. And the Pew Center says the Latino vote could be the swing in this year's presidential election. But a new study by Dr. Paula McLean, a political scientist at Duke University, says when trying to predict how Latinos will vote, political observers need to be careful.
What we've missed is that there's so much that's been structured in the popular media that goes on the basis that blacks and Latinos, because of their shared minority status, should therefore have lots of things in common, and therefore they're going to walk hand in hand or stand in a circle and sing Kumbaya. We have not really, only until the last, couple decades for social scientists, begin to think, maybe that's not really the case. Maybe shared minority status doesn't necessarily lead to similarities, but may in fact lead to differences.
And Dr. McLean's study is finding just that.
Latino immigrants see themselves as having more in common with whites and perceive themselves as closer to whites and the farthest away from blacks, that they feel they really don't have anything in common with blacks.
So those feelings could come into play in Arizona and other states as voters head to the polls, especially in the Democratic race for the nomination.
For some members of the various Latino groups where the anti-black effect is strong, that we would in fact see them maybe gravitating more to Hillary Clinton because of her race and away from Obama because of his. Now, this is clearly not, one can't do this broad sweep and say that this holds for all Latinos, but what we have seen is that for those individuals with this high degree of stereotype, beliefs and stereotypes about blacks, there's a tendency to really see themselves as being closer to whites and the farthest away from blacks of all the groups that we asked them.
Earlier this week, Congressman Raul Grijalva endorsed Senator Barack Obama and says he expects Latinos to come around to the Obama camp.
I think as the Latino community becomes more and more familiar with who Barack Obama is, what he represents, that momentum will pick up as it is picking up across the country. You have to understand something about the Latino community, fiercely independent voters, and more importantly, a very young community. And I think the issue of the future and the issue of change that we are going to bring to the community, Latino communities in this campaign, is going to resonate, and I think that's what's going to carry the day.
In Florida's primary, Latino voters backed Senator Hillary Clinton by a 2-to-1 margin over Senator Obama. And 51% of Hispanics backed Senator John McCain on the Republican side of the ballot. But McCain's chief rival, Governor Mitt Romney, is not ceding that vote without a fight.
Un líder que realmente sepa cómo salvar la situación económica. Mitt Romney es conocido como el mejor empresario de América. Sabe cómo funciona.
According to the Pew Hispanic Center, 57% of Latino voters identify themselves as Democrat, or at least say they have Democratic leanings. Only 23% say that for Republicans. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Blazing a new trail in Arizona politics, this year the Tucson Weekly opened the door to their readership to run for president. They've provided a platform for a wide field of candidates to make their voices heard, and from that field they've chosen one Democrat and one Republican to endorse in next week's presidential primary. I asked the Weekly's Jim Nintzel to give us the latest news.
Well, we are at crunch time. The presidential primary election is next Tuesday, February 5th. The candidates are all out there working really hard, and I think our final endorsement this week in the Tucson Weekly, on the Republican side of the aisle, we endorsed Sean C.F. Murphy, and on the Democratic side, we endorsed Chuck C.
Now, there was a reader's endorsement poll recently on your site, and the results of the reader's choices don't exactly match up with the official endorsements. Can you explain that?
Well, we kind of saw ourselves as the Electoral College, ready to correct the mistakes of the common man. But we did open it up to popular vote and allowed people to go ahead and cast ballots. We actually had a little bit of a voter integrity problem with that. Our polls closed an hour early on the first elimination round, and possibly millions of Americans were disenfranchised from being able to cast a ballot in that race.
You also had a televised debate recently. How did that go?
Televised debate was simply spectacular. We had four of the candidates appearing on stage. We had questions from you, the viewer. The YouTube viewer posted questions up there, and we took the questions straight from them. And I think it was a really good exchange of ideas that gave these candidates a chance to really introduce themselves to the American people. Also, it is available on the Project White House YouTube channel and is repeating every night between now and Election Day on Access Tucson at 8 p.m.
What were some of the important issues that got tackled that night?
Well, I think they were the same issues that are really close to a lot of Americans, issues about immigration and climate change and UFOs. And, I think the candidates handled those very well. There was a real mix of opinion on all of those topics. Some folks felt as though it was unsafe to release the UFO files for fear of creating a panic in the streets. Others felt as though we could turn to our space brothers to help us solve many of the problems that we're facing.
So did everybody behave like presidential material?
Oh, absolutely. I was very impressed. The four candidates, Doctress Newtopia, Peter Bolander, Chuck C., and Charles Skelly, our lone Republican, all really, I think, you could say each and every one of them hit a home run in that debate.
So of your endorsements, Sean C.F. Murphy, any idea what the C.F. stands for?
He still has not told us what the C.F. stands for.
It's mysterious.
It is mysterious, but I think what we liked about Sean was he showed that he did not have any actual stance on any of the issues, but instead was reaching out and was willing to say or do anything that the people wanted him to do in order to earn their vote. And that showed us that, you know, that's what we're really after, I think, in a presidential candidate these days. When you look at the mainstream candidates, the Mitt Romneys and the John McCains, it's clear that they're going to do the exact same thing. So that's why we went with Sean.
An open mind.
An open mind.
Well, over on the Democratic side of things, Chuck C. is keeping a slightly lower profile than Sean Murphy. What are his chances?
Oh, I think Chuck really did a fantastic job towards the end of this. He managed to get out into the debate, showed that he had a lot of good things to say, and I think really expressed himself really well at the end of the campaign.
Can you tell us anything about Chuck's platform?
Chuck really wants to try to fix the world before it's too late.
Noble.
Indeed it is.
So have any of the any of the more nationally recognized candidates, have they responded to Project White House?
You know, we almost got Mike Gravel involved. None of the others really had the guts to participate, but we did get a call back from the Gravel campaign, and they were considering it. But then when we explained to them what Project White House was, we never heard from them again.
Jim, when you were here before, you said that one of the goals of Project White House was to interject some vitality and maybe some chaos into Arizona's electoral process. Do you feel like you've succeeded?
Vitality, certainly. I think people have definitely been very engaged in coming up with alternative ideas for the future of the country. As far as chaos goes, I'm terribly disappointed. It looks like pretty much business as usual out there.
Besides the Project White House candidates that we're all very excited about, do you have any other thoughts you'd like to share on the upcoming primary?
Well, I can say that I think Barack Obama is making an amazing push here at the last minute of the last week of the campaign. We certainly see him capturing a lot of endorsements from our local city council people, from a lot of state lawmakers, and also here just this week, Raul Grijalva, which could be a real impressive endorsement for him. And I think he's got a lot of momentum on his side. Whether that can overcome Hillary or not remains to be seen.
Well, Jim, I thank you for your time and for your keen analysis. We'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
We've got links to the Project White House blog and their YouTube channel, which features campaign ads and the full televised debate online at KUAZ.org. Along with hiking, climbing, and mountain biking, birding is a popular outdoor activity in Arizona. But recently, bird experts have been noticing that there aren't as many birds around as there used to be. Next, Robert Rappaport looks at some reasons why.
Two recent studies show Arizona's bird population is in peril. Tucson Audubon Society Executive Director Dr. Paul Green says population statistics over the past 40 years indicate some common birds are in decline in southern Arizona. One of the biggest declines is in the population of this bird, the American kestrel.
Kestrels are a very interesting point, species in question. Kestrels, again, are cavity nesters. They're small birds of prey. Typically, you'd see them on the side of the road, on a fence post or on a power line, just watching for small insects and small rodents, which they can eat. So kestrels have declined by about 83%, and again, that's probably a result of changes in their habitat. They do like areas where they with clear grassland that they can see, with good insect abundance.
Green attributes much of the population declines to the loss of habitat.
We have a situation in southern Arizona where we see a lot of sprawl. That's fairly low density construction of buildings over a large area instead of the buildings being concentrated or focused into small urban kind of settlements. And the result of that, of course, is that the habitat gets, large areas of habitat get degraded, simplified, and the special requirements that many species have disappear. So when we get development, we get a simplification of the habitat. And in other words, a lot of the special requirements for the birds are disappearing.
One of the effects of development is the need for more groundwater. Green says that, coupled with a long period of drought, also plays a part in the bird decline.
As we pump the water and use the water during development and the water table declines, so the rivers dry. And once the water goes down, the vegetation dies. Once the water table gets down about 10 feet beneath the surface, our cottonwoods will die. And cottonwood willow habitat is very, very important. Once the water gets below about 50 feet below the surface, we lose our mesquite trees. Mesquite trees are also very important. So we have to be very much aware as we move ahead about our use of water, and just remember that the more water we use, the greater threats we pose to our birds.
Green also says the introduction of non-native species to the landscape can affect the natural inhabitants of the land.
Buffalo grass, for example, is spreading across the Sonoran Desert, and it's a danger because buffalo grass is very susceptible to fire, and it burns at a very high temperature, and it basically sterilizes the soil, making regeneration of natural habitat with native species very difficult without intervention by people. There are many other native species, and it's most important that especially when people move into developments in natural areas, surrounded by natural areas, that they only bring native species of plants into their backyards, because by bringing in exotic species which may be invasive, you're bringing about the destruction of the habitat surrounding your development.
The studies used to determine bird decline are 40 years of statistics from the National Breeding Bird Survey and the annual Christmas bird counts. Larry Leese was the volunteer compiler for this year's Tucson bird count, which he admits is not the most scientific.
This will be a wintertime set of data, which is going to be very different from the breeding season. Birds in North America generally breed in the spring and summer. So in the wintering, we get a lot of northern birds that winter in our area because of a lack of food or colder temperatures further north. So a lot of birds come south for the winter, and some of them only go this far south. So we'll see the wintering numbers here.
Even though we've seen a decline in native birds and 47 bird species are on the 2007 Audubon and American Bird Conservancy watch list, Dr. Paul Green of the Tucson Audubon Society says it's not too late for government, developers, and homeowners to help reverse the trend.
It is never too late. We can always do things to enhance habitats. All kinds of organizations are working throughout the state. The Nature Conservancy has been especially active on this point to recreate habitats, and Tucson Audubon is doing a lot of habitat restoration along the Santa Cruz River, and we're just watching for the birds to come back.
Green says it's important developers and others come together before final building plans are made to determine the best way to prevent the loss of bird habitat. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Robert Rappaport.
The Tucson Audubon Society will be meeting on Thursday next week with the Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors and the city planners to discuss ways to preserve natural areas during development. And now, here's Stephanie Varney with a look at some events happening this weekend.
The Tucson Young Professionals are hosting a carnival-themed party for their First Friday's event, inviting all levels of professionals to this social gathering that includes drinks, dancing, and live art. Participants are encouraged to wear masks and colorful dress. It all starts tonight at 9 p.m. 613, a New York-based a cappella band, is coming to Tucson this weekend. The group mixes Jewish texts and modern rhythms to produce music that ranges from hip-hop to rock. 613 will perform at the Tucson Jewish Community Center this Saturday at 8 p.m. Tickets are also available at jewishtucson.org. An evening with award-winning Native American flute player Scott August is being presented next week at a benefit concert at San Pedro Chapel. The concert is Thursday, February 7th at 7 p.m. More information and tickets are available at 325-3843. The 49th annual Tubac Festival of the Arts is this Wednesday at Tubac Village. Horse-drawn trolleys will shuttle visitors around the village while they enjoy art, entertainment, including Aztec folk dancers, and food. It all starts February 6th at 10 a.m. and continues every day until February 10th. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Stephanie Varney.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. The music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. I'm Mark McLemore.